The Guardian.
Welcome to a special podcast featuring conductor Geoffrey Tait in conversation with Christopher Cook. Geoffrey Tait began his conducting career at Covent Garden in the 1970s under the watchful eye of Sir George Scholte. And now Tait is back at the Royal Opera House to conduct Wagner's Flying Dutchman. Here he talks about what makes a great conductor, his baptism of fire with Lulu, and how he once had to attempt emergency surgery to remove a baton from Scholte's hand.
Should we start with Flying Dutchman? Is Dutchman a piece that you very much like?
Well, I began by not liking it very much, I have to tell you, a long, long time ago. I saw it probably here and found it a bit facile. But I was a very unpleasant, rather opinionated teenager. Of course, came to understand why it is as it is, and in fact then to love it, because it has its own world, its own particular poetry. Actually, now I think I enjoy it infinitely more.
I was going to say that had Wagner died, and this was the last opera that he wrote, we should, of course, be seeing it as the apogee of what German romantic opera ought to be.
I think it is. I mean, I think it's the end of something as well as the beginning, most certainly. And I think if he had not written the rest, we'd still say this is a masterpiece. It has extraordinary things that you don't find in Weber, but you don't actually find in Schumann. I mean, this is someone with a particular sort of theatrical poetry. I think that's what makes it stick out from the rest. He understood or felt for the theatre.
And it begins absolutely with the first bar, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know you're in a theatre.
Yes, you're in a theatre, but you also know that you're in for a fantastic ride. That overture sort of sweeps you away. And yet, at the same time, it is an overture and not a summing up of all that happens. I mean, you know, you want it to go on after that. The end, I'm never quite sure what the end really means. It's very difficult to pull off the end. Mm. What happens to her? Does she die? Does he go up to heaven? I really don't know the answer to that. Somehow, he's looking for a solution which he doesn't quite find. Mm. It's very interesting that he was always obsessed with the idea of the ends of these things.
The number of operas with satisfactory conclusions by Wagner is probably only one and a bit, isn't it?
Which one and a bit would you... I want to know the ones and
well,
a bit. I don't entirely agree with you.
I was going to say Parsifal and Tristan.
Oh, no, you have to... I mean, come on, the end of Rheingold is...
Oh, I'm doing the whole cycle.
Well, even the end of Götterdämmerung, I wouldn't sort of throw out with the bathwater. I happen to like the end of Meistersinger, although, of course, it has perhaps for non-German certain problems with all that nonsense, which some people turn into Nazism or whatever they like to call it. I mean, I don't think it's that. I mean, in a wonderful performance of Meistersinger, those last blazing C major chords are some of the most exciting things you can actually hear. Now, I think he knew how to end things.
Let's go back to beginnings. I know that you began by training to be a doctor and that music won, to our great advantage. How did that decision propose itself to you when you were a young man?
It was a decision that I probably made in my heart fairly early on, probably even before I was a teenager. I mean, I knew that I was somehow attracted to the arts, particularly to the theatre, interesting enough, although I played the piano and sang, but I loved the theatre and thought I could have been an actor, but, you know, obviously with my disability, that wasn't on. The number of roles available to be rather limited, although rather good roles, in fact. Even though, I mean, you know, but you were stilly, you know, you could be a consultant in Harley Street and rolling it in, whereas I had no idea what I would do as a musician. But I joined this place almost immediately after leaving medicine. And they paid not badly, and I just loved being in the theatre. I have to say, this theatre was very special to be in.
Had you come a lot as a young man to the house here?
As an adolescent, before I went to Cambridge, I'd only been about a couple of times. I had seen an absolutely ghastly production of Tristan, which was sort of yellow and grey, I remember, and everyone wore nasty sort of leathery costumes. It was very horrid to look at. And then when I was in Cambridge, we had a group of us, led by someone from Clare, who encouraged us to go down and sleep on the pavement and buy cheap amphitheatre seats. So I actually then began to see quite a lot. The worst thing was queuing over a weekend, sleeping on the pavement, for seats for Callas doing Tosca. As you well remember, she cancelled. And so, I mean, I saw the lovely Marie Collier, but poor Marie Collier didn't look in. I was furious.
You make it sound astonishingly easy, as if you left Cambridge having decided to do music and you arrived at the Opera House. What actually happened?
I mean, I was always quite a... I was an unusual pianist, but quite good at doing what I did, which was the sight read. I taught myself to play the piano. The last piano lesson I had was, I think, when I was 10. But I'd gone on playing, and I taught myself, actually, by playing scores. So, in a way, I was predestined to become a repetiteur, a coach. When I went and did my audition here... What I didn't know was it had already been given to somebody, one of those sort of English corrupt things, you know? And I came to do my audition, and then they rang me and said, yes, well, we'd given the place already to somebody else, but we think you're the right person. We wanted to expand, so we'll take you on. You've got to play to Scholti, which was terrifying. And then I got a phone call thinking, this is it, I go, and I play. And I was ushered into John Tooley's office, which was, he was then assistant to David Repster, and he said, yes, we want to sign your contract. And I didn't have to pay the shot. Apparently, he'd said, you know, if he's good enough for you, he's good enough for me. Yeah. So I found myself literally after 6 months, I'd left medicine in the summer. This was Easter time, actually on the staff of Covent Garden.
Do you think it's a good thing for a conductor to begin his career in opera house?
I think it's a very good thing, but I'm a little bit old-fashioned in that sense. I mean, I think the old school, that is of doing all the jobs that you do in an opera house, coach singers, play for rehearsals, watch conductors, take notes, do backstage work. I think that is an invaluable way. When I was in Covent Garden, I never thought that I would conduct. But nonetheless, I know for well that that is the right way, I think. And what I learned later is, of course, when you come to the symphonic repertory, your feeling for singers, of working with singers, helped you enormously when you come to phrasing and that sort of thing, working with woodwind, working with brass, because it's the same problem. In fact, obviously, you know, those 6 or 7 years that I was working here and then in Cologne, I mean, I got to know the repertory that is very important to the operatic repertory, inside out and backwards.
What was it like working with Scholti?
Well, it was a bit terrifying because, you know, he really was this rather very nervous, very sort of energetic approach that he had to things. You know, you really had to be on top of it, absolutely. He was probably the most efficient recorder in a studio that I'd ever met. I mean, he really knew how to use his time. I mean, I noticed that also in the opera house. I mean, that sounds an odd thing to say, but if you've got just 3 hours to do things in, you really have to know how to use that, and he really knew. I didn't always approve of what he was doing musically. That's a totally different matter. But in terms of the discipline necessary and the energy necessary, all of that he had, it was amazing. I got an enormous amount out of him. You know, he was terrified of, for instance, of illness. And I once turned up at his house in St. John's Wood because he was recording, I think, La Bohème for RCA or something. And I really wasn't very well. I was actually going down with glandular fever, which I didn't know. And I turned up sort of and said on the doorstep rather than with him, George, I really don't feel awfully well, but I've come. He said, go on, go on. He couldn't bear the thought that anyone ill would come anywhere near him. He also, he was conducting the Good Friday music. Yeah, because I worked with him on the recording of Parsifal, Acts 1 and 3. It had already been done. Act 2 had already been done. And it was my first visit to Vienna. And there was suddenly a scream from Scholti. He'd actually stuck his baton in his hand. How you do that in the Good Friday music, I don't know, but he'd done it. And there was Valerie, his wife, who said, Geoffrey, please do something. And I literally took out a needle from my handbag, flamed it over her, and sort of poked around in this poor man's hand, and then gave up, because I did, you know, I mean, George, I'll do you more harm than good. And he was very worried, and the Decca was worried, because they had literally one session more, and he had to finish it. He wouldn't record any more that day. They took him off to be x-rayed. Although I said, I don't think you've broken anything, George. You know, but no. And then about a month later, he was conducting Das Lied von der Erde at the Royal Festival Hall. And I was in the queue, you know, after the concert, queued up to say hello to him. And he could see I was there. And he hurried through everybody and said, Geoffrey, it came out. I said, what came out? And he said, it came out. And apparently, he'd taken it, first of all, to his orthopedic surgeon, who said, there's nothing I can do for you. And then literally, while he was doing something else, it popped out. I mean, nevertheless, they do these things. It's wonderful. And he then, as a gift after that, I was given these LPs from him to my personal physician and friend from Georg Scholti, which is, I mean, a very beloved possession of mine.
You presumably also were here over the kind of transition from Scholti to Colin Davis. Mm-hmm. If you were outside the house, you see the big difference. Did that...
Huge. I was the last year of Scholti. That was the last year. And then Colin came, and of course Colin, you know, none of this sort of Middle European auteur or anything like that. This was, you know, hands-on, good English, and we were all friends together. I mean, it was completely different. Completely different. Colin was extremely interested in vocal production, and particularly Italianate. It was a difficult time for the whole house, because Colin was trying to do something very special and never really achieved the sort of recognition here.
It's very interesting you say, because in retrospect, it seems so astonishingly mean-minded, given what eventually the whole of the period achieved. I mean, Berlioz restored to the centre of the repertoire, possibly with the 76 ring, one of the great Covent Garden rings,
yes,
Friedrich's first ring.
I think I absolutely agree with you. I mean, one did felt slightly under siege at times.
I wonder whether working with Davis informed also your feelings about Mozart and how you wanted to do it, or is it always something that was just inside you?
I think it's always been inside me. I mean, I remember listening to the famous Colin concert performance of Don Giovanni when he stood in for Klemperer and thinking, my God, this is rather wonderful. And I'd sung under Colin in Cambridge. He came up and did with the Chelsea Opera Group Damnation of Faust, which I thought was fantastic. When Colin did Mozart here, I mean, yes, I respected it, but I probably already moved on. I wanted something maybe slightly different, more edgy. I don't know. I mean, it was less my world by that time, but that was simply because I was evolving. You know, you look at somebody else doing with a critical eye. You have to. You know, I have my own world and I want to keep that world. And I think probably we weren't that far away from each other now, looking back on it. What happens now is much more extreme, you know, much, much more extreme. We both had this vision that the woodwind should be forward, you know, the string articulation to be very clean. I mean, all these sorts of things. Basically, that was an agreement. It's how you phrased, and also tempo. Because I was in my Klemperer phase in those days, and rather resented fast tempi.
Pretty dangerous ways of doing
Very, things. Very, very dangerous. I mean, because particularly when it comes to conducting Wagner, you know, you have to be very, very careful of letting, you know, of copying. Mm-hmm. In Colin's case, I mean, you know, his Wagner was so different from what I would want to do, it didn't matter. But with Mozart, maybe, who knows?
We've talked about Klemperer, Davis, Scholti, Vaccarian. What you come to conclude about what a good conductor, what a great conductor is? I mean, what are the qualities that inform the ideal man on the podium?
Knowledge. Without any question, you have to know what you want. Then you have to have, I think, today, an acute sense of what other people are, because I don't think you can no longer stand in front of an orchestra and do what the sort of tyrants, the great tyrants, did 50 years ago or earlier. You know, I mean, terrifying everyone. You can't terrify people anymore into doing what you want to do. You have to do with love, I think. And then there's an indefinable thing which all these people you've talked about have, which you can't quantify or can't even really talk about. You know, why Karajan got the sound he did, I will never know. But he got it because of what he was. His hands said something. I became very friendly for a short amount of time with Carlos Kleiber because I played for him when he came. He would turn up at Karajan recordings. He said, you know, that old man, he gets a sound there. I've tried and I've tried and I've tried to get it. I have no idea how he gets it. And he was sat in his rehearsals to see if he could ever determine how that sound came. Now, if Carlos Schreiber says that, you see what a mystery that it is, because Carlos could do almost anything. But there is some indefinable thing.
Can we talk about Lulu? I mean, that astonishing moment in your career, the Met rings and says, will you come and do Lulu?
I must explain how that happened. Jimmy Levine took me onto his staff, and he watched my conducting of an ensemble rehearsal of Mahagoni, which he was doing. He said, next season, you're going to assist me on the new Cosi, and then on the new Lulu. Well, I mean, I knew Lulu very well because I'd assisted Boulez for the world premiere of the three-act version. So, I mean, you know, I really did know the piece fairly well. And I said, that's a wonderful idea. And he said, I would like you to conduct a Lulu. I thought, ooh. Then the Met went on strike. Cosi went out of the window. They went back to work, and I, of course, started to work on Lulu. And there was this threat of Lulu on Boxing Day, which I was meant to conduct. And I remember I had brunch with Jimmy under Brooklyn Bridge and the River Cafe and said to Jimmy, I can't do this. There's no way I can do this. You can't expect me to make my Met debut in a piece that I've actually never conducted with an orchestra without a single rehearsal. He said, you'll be all right. Just do it. Just do it. Well, it ruined Christmas. The only really catastrophic thing was in the middle of the film music, in the second act, where the music winds up to a middle point and then unwinds again. It's a palindrome. As it began to wind up again, which is in the cello, my glasses fell off and fell in the lap of the first viola player, and I couldn't see a thing. And it's the one part of Lulu that's just in 4-4 and only in 4-4, which is a miracle, for about a minute. So I just went on conducting 4, and eventually, thank God, the first viola put, you know, I got them back. Otherwise than that, I emerged relatively unscathed.
Yes, but you're being very modest. You've got very good notices.
I got very good, yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, Lulu's that sort of piece. It's very rare to get savaged for conducting Lulu.
It's obvious from what you've just said, but also from things you said earlier, that you obviously like singers hugely.
Well, I sang as a child. I mean, I think that's probably what actually helped. I was actually rather a good boy soprano. When I went to Cambridge, I actually sang for both the University Music Society and the Madrigal Society, which was Raymond Leppard. I had a fantastic time in Cambridge singing madrigals with Ray. I mean, you can imagine, that taught me a lot. And then when I came down to London, I sang in the Philharmonic Chorus.
But is there a pleasure in working with singers?
Yes.
The nuts and bolts, the kind of sweat and...
That's the most enjoyable thing of all. I mean, I get a great kick out of working with singers and talking about, you know, how you do this vowel, where to put that consonant, all those sort of purely technical things, which really fascinate me, and obviously fascinate singers, because it's what it's about.
Have you noticed, in the time you've been conducting, singers changing, by which I don't mean what we like in singers in terms of the instrument, but singers as performers change?
Singers have become, over the 30 or 40 years that I've been involved with this business, I mean, they've become much more disciplined, musically more disciplined. I mean, the sort of thing that you expected from the Anglo-Saxon school when I was starting and didn't really get, even in Germany or in Italy, the sort of discipline that was very much rooted here, is now everywhere. It's very rare to come across a singer who hasn't learned the role impeccably and understand why it's written in that particular way. I mean, so our work has actually got much easier. Also, singers have become very aware, I think, of the stage and acting. I mean, they're also, again, forced to, because we live in an increasingly visual age.
Can we talk about directors? Directors have changed a lot in the last 30 years, too.
Yes, I mean, I suppose because I've been working in Germany a lot, I've become more used to the change than you have. I'm a little bit of a renegade in that sense, because I actually am very interested in production, and I think it's actually valid to experiment, because we have this fixed repertoire. New pieces hardly ever crop up. Why not look at theatrically what you could do with them? I mean, I know that music forces to a degree a production on people, but nonetheless, I think it behoves us to look differently sometimes at pieces to see if we can't illuminate something. So I'm all for this sort of experimenting, and that's become a bone of contention, as you well know. I think it's very important to experiment theatrically so that opera remains living. Otherwise, it becomes a bit of a museum if you're not very careful. I had fantastic 5 years with Cheryl doing the Ring in Barrett, which I understood exactly what he was doing and loved it. And, I mean, I'm very happy always to try. Otherwise, it really is a little bit fussy in what happened.
That extraordinary 1976 centenary production of The Ring by Roy. What was it like working with not only Cheryl, but also, of course, with Boulez?
We arrived in Bayreuth, I think, just before my birthday, I mean, 27th of April, first night in July. So, and we were all on our own, and we worked 3 sessions a day. Pierre didn't turn up until quite late. He trusted me to do it, which was amazing. And I think probably that trust was one of the real impulses that enabled me later then to conduct. Because he met me in London, and then we spent an extraordinary weekend in Baden-Baden. He has a house in Baden-Baden. It's a bit like an atomic submarine, the house, as you probably would imagine it would be. The kitchen looks as though no one's ever done anything except open capsules. And we were in a basement, which was his music room, sitting on beanbags, and we actually listened, interestingly enough, to the Furtwängler Ring. Mm. And then when it came to the orchestra rehearsals, that really taught me a great deal. It taught me a great deal about Wagner, listening to Boulez. Not that I didn't approve of his tempi or his phrasing, but I approved entirely of the ear for the texture of the orchestra and what the orchestra was actually doing, which the Bayreuthers loathed that ear, because he wanted to get rid of all that sort of unnecessary, hard sound. You know, he said, look at the score. You know, this is Mark Piano. Why are you playing forte here? And he was stubborn as hell, as a result of which a lot of the orchestra didn't come back the second year, and they got a new orchestra. But gradually, the two came together, and he began to absorb the piece in a different way from just an intellectual conception.
Your own first ring was again a kind of extraordinary watershed, but it was the first ring in Paris that had been made in Paris since the end of the Second World War, wasn't it?
I've had quite a lot of luck with that. I was given an enormous amount of rehearsal time for the orchestra by Radio France, which was a wonderful privilege. This is a symphonic orchestra who then get to sit in the pit and actually love it, whereas, of course, a pit orchestra loathed the pit and loved to get out of the pit. Every time I come to conduct one of these four operas, I have to look at it from completely different eyes. I mean, you every time you think, did I really do that last time like that? Because the piece in itself is perhaps not perfect in a human sense. You have to make decisions when you conduct that piece about transitions. I mean, Wagner said it's all about transitions and then left you in the dark as to what these transitions should be. And every time you conduct it, you have to think about those transitions. So I don't think I shall ever be satisfied. I'm getting closer to the sound I want, though. If you can't make an audience cry, you have failed to conduct The Ring properly.
Jeffrey Tate, thank you very much for being with us this evening. Thank you very much.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.